It's the middle of the 19th century. The Industrial Revolution is advancing at breakneck speed, and the thrust for advanced reasoning continues apace. While the 49ers were busy getting rich off newfound seams of California gold, the true global currency was the perpetuation of deduction. Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, was published in 1859. Decried by the church, this extraordinary tome and its suppositions were subject to various counterclaims as to how life on Earth began. Determined to discredit Darwin's findings, Theodore Livingstalk, a renowned Oxford scholar, published The Origin of Mises, in which he claimed man descended from mice. It was another theory the church balked at and maintained they hated the origin of Mises to pieces. Dr. Archibald Spritevessel, chief medical officer at the newly founded Battersea Dogs Home, penned a letter to the Daily Telegraph entitled The Hand of Dog. His correspondents argued that early man was more canine than simian and that they were most likely dyslexic. Finally, Elizabeth Pickleton, granddaughter of Sir Charles Pickleton, the great onion magnate, and by that I mean entrepreneur rather than someone simply attracted to the vegetable, published a series of papers in The Lancet which illustratively showed how man evolved from the collection of toy dolls she kept in an understairs cupboard. Each challenge to Darwin's work failed to stand up to scrutiny, and as such, mankind was resigned to the fact that our ancestors were all monkey fuckers. It was a bitter pill for the church to swallow, and, to this day, many men and women of the cloth denounce this reasoning, even if their face does indeed resemble a slapped baboon's arse. I'm Sir General Roland Frampton, and I'll be recognizing the sweat, blood, and tears of those who didn't quite make the grade. So, the next time you find yourself describing the extraordinarily ambitious aims of the Geneva Convention to a vicious South American dictator or a sex worker in Suffolk, kindly remember the Aylesbury branch of tree detectives had structured precisely the same treaty, but the group felt unable to abandon a nasty case of Dutch elm disease in neighbouring Watford, and their moment was lost.
We live in a world of fine margins. A brief history of failure, presented by Sir General Roland Frampton. Episode 6, New Reasonings.
So, let us away to a new phase of radical reasoning which would challenge the mindset of any self-respecting commoner with an IQ higher than a grape. Analysis and conclusions that would have perpetuated easily if it wasn't for interfering ignoramuses who wouldn't stop sticking their oars in with hopeless repudiations. Medieval clever Dick, King Charlemagne once said, to have another language is to possess a second soul, words he most likely espoused before hacking off the head of another untrustworthy foreigner. As the Industrial Revolution brought new and wondrous machines and efficiencies into everyday life, the importance of language and the need to communicate across borders was in sharp focus. Talking French with a German, negotiating in Cantonese with the Swiss, speaking Welsh to cattle, mastering the languages of trade and business, was the difference between success and failure in the mid-19th century. And within the walls of the new factories, industrial leviathans that now peppered the landscape, variations of the common language were instigated by workers fixated on making conversation completely indecipherable. Around factory furnaces, nonsense such as Cockney rhyming slang and Geordie gibberish would rise from the flames. An early forerunner of Cockney rhyming slang was a Dorset version compiled by the Parson of Bournemouth. While designed specifically for use within the county, the phrases were seen as overly aggressive and were quickly abandoned by the public. With me to highlight some of the failings of Dorset rhyming slang is prominent linguist and speech therapist to the stars, Simon Coagulant.
Nice to be with you, Sir Roland.
Can you provide us with some examples of the phrases employed by these carrot crunchers at the time?
No problem. I'll give you the rhyming phrase, its definition, and a common usage.
Perfect.
Why don't we start with apples and peas? This phrase meant bubonic fleas, so a common use for it might be, your dog's got apples.
Fantastic. Were there any medical references in the mix?
Ooh, let me see. Yes, here we go. College refectory, which meant hysterectomy. So you might hear, she died having a college. There's another one here, which was popular with landlords at the time. Jammy Dodger, which translates as stinking lodger. That jammy owes me a sheep, would often be heard around Weymouth slums.
Fascinating. Do you have one more for our listeners before we leave you?
Okay, I'll give you the common usage and see if you can work out what it is. Right, I'm off for a Rameses, as in Rameses the Great.
Oh, right, I'm off for a date. No, off to a fate. Oh no, I don't know.
Masturbate, you know, off for a wank.
As the Industrial Revolution signaled the change from a handicraft economy to one dominated by machine manufacturing, the space created brought a profusion of thinking into play. In 1851, the Prime Meridian was established by Sir George Airy at the Greenwich Royal Observatory, finally enabling sailors to deliver conkers to Botswana. Before Airy's line was internationally recognised, however, there were a series of counter-proposals for the arbitrary position of 0 degrees longitude. To discuss with me the positions of said counter-proposal is the great-granddaughter of Sir George Airy, Mary Airy. Mary, how many location proposals were on the table?
Literally thousands, Sir Roland. Burkina Faso's president, Mark Cubber Sunshine, argued the true position of the meridian was through his wife and members of his family.
Extraordinary. Didn't the Cape of Good Hope Penguin Appreciation Society claim 0 degrees longitude ran through one of its camouflaged hides at Ornithology Point in Antarctica?
They did, but that was one of the less ridiculous proposals. There was a stall at Granger Market in Newcastle upon Tyne that sold squirrel slippers, which the mayoress of Newcastle, Gladys Stephen Stevens, vigorously campaigned to be recognised as the geographical reference point.
What a pointless waste of time and energy.
Oh, that was only the start. The rejection she received from the British Geographical Society only spurred Mrs. Stephen Stevens on. The following year, she put up the market's vintage fungus stall as the official location of the equator. And 2 years after that, she cited the fresh frog oil tent as the international dateline.
Of course, it wasn't all work and no play for these industrialists, inventors, and inept interlopers. Victorians were enjoying the new popular forms of public entertainment. Vaudeville was a theatrical show featuring singers, musicians, and comics popular across all social classes. The circus was also proving a hit with the masses when Barnum and Bailey joined the forces of two already well-established circus operations. They took the world by storm with mind-boggling acts and attractions. There was a plethora of pretenders to the Barnum and Bailey crown, but many didn't cut the mustard with the paying public. The following is an old recording of the acts on show at the Collins and Colitis Circus Extravaganza in Frankfurt, 1875.
Circus impresarios Collins and Colitis are proud to announce the outstanding lineup for this weekend's extravaganza. Behold, the one-headed man. Be amazed at the amazing celery eater. Look again. Lionel Biggins. Is he wood or is he plastic? Observe Jeff and Jane, the bearded librarian twins. Meet old Father Time. He's an astonishing 36 years old. Beware the evil charms of Catwoman. She stinks of piss. And you'll not believe Canine Colin. He can lick his own nuts. Show tickets available now. A shilling on the door or 3 guineas if you book through Ye Olde Ticketmaster.
In 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th president of the United States. At 6'4" tall, Lincoln is the tallest mammal to have served as the country's leader. While this height advantage made Lincoln particularly useful for getting Christmas decorations out of the loft, it also offered up a sizable target for any would-be assassin, which is why on April 15, 1865, he was shot. Before his death, Lincoln was able to win a civil war, add the 13th Amendment to the US Constitution, thereby abolishing slavery, and took an executive decision to pardon naughty chickens. several other amendments had already been lined up to get the nod on number 13 before Lincoln shoehorned his Emancipation Bill into the mix.
The right to beat beggars and tramp senseless was an amendment championed by Postmaster General wannabe, Paul Michael Glaser.
Susie Swinebuckle is an authority on U.S. constitutional law and someone who also knows how to keep custard at the perfect temperature.
The battle to ratify any number of suggestions for the 13th Amendment is a dark and largely unknown slice of American history. They were an unwarranted distraction, which took the focus of Lincoln's cabinet away from the bigger issues of the day. Ulysses B. Grant, a lookalike actor working the clubs and abattoirs along the Delaware, proposed that the 13th Amendment be the universal freedom to prosecute any family member who was unable to bear witness in a civil jury trial via due process and self-incrimination. Deemed by the House Speaker as utter twaddle, Grant's proposal was torn to shreds in front of him. Confederate sympathizer Terry Savalas ventured that every American citizen should have the God-given right to bark at their neighbors, the moon, or any incidental gathering. The right to free woofing was never adopted, however. The adoption of the abolition of slavery put paid to these ridiculous suggestions only for the whole palaver to start over again for the 14th Amendment, and then the 15th, then the 16th, and so on. Honestly, what a ball ache.
This age of reasoning and foresight was probably best underscored by the discovery of X-rays in 1895. The man who took the glory for their discovery was German professor of physics, Wilhelm Röntgen. Sadly, however, the contribution of many other scientists had been overlooked when Röntgen was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1901. German orthodontist and keen ornithologist Hansi von Schmanzi has published several books on those sidelined by Röntgen's discovery and has also penned several delicate poems about blue tits.
You must understand, Sir Roland, that Röntgen was a very humble man. He did not seek patents for his discoveries, holding the view that they should be publicly available without charge. So, while he was happy to collaborate, he never felt those who approached him had anything of merit to offer.
I assume, Herr von Schmanzi, that Röntgen wasn't just plagiarizing the work of other scientists to advance his own research.
Huh, typical. Any chance you English get to undermine German excellence?
I believe it's a valid question.
Well, let's examine some of the help Röntgen was offered, and you tell me if you'd have taken any of this nonsense on board.
Fair enough.
Take the Italian physicist Carlo Alla Romana, who tried to persuade Röntgen that he had determined the required levels for safe irradiation. This was a man who literally fell apart on the way to pick up his grandmother from Bologna train station. Then there's the eminent Welsh electrician, Di Carpet, who hounded Wilhelm for months over the fact that if X-rays contained a hyphen, it would prohibit its use in future board games such as Scrabble. Finally, US physicist and convicted serial killer Kathleen Balustrade sent Röntgen dozens of so-called X-rays of human bones. Gutted that he had been beaten to the punch, it transpired that these were merely photographs of Balustrade's victims that had been dug up from the garden by the family dog. Chuckles. Anything there of any merit, Frampton?
Probably not. Soon, the end of the 19th century was upon us, and despite great advances in industry, invention, and reasoning across the world, dark, portentous clouds were brewing overhead. The promise of a bold, peaceful future had been epitomized in historic events such as the opening of the Suez Canal, the opening of the Manchester Ship Canal, and the opening of the Alimentary Canal. But at the turn of the 20th century, the failure of mankind to just keep its shit together once and for all would lead to global discord, turmoil, and ultimately the descent into war on an unimaginable scale. Next time on A Brief History of Failure, as Norway prepares to separate itself from Sweden, I'll be asking why Oslo housewife Gabriella Wikström and many like her got the wrong end of the geopolitical stick.
As soon as we heard the union between our two countries was being ripped apart, I immediately roused out and bought sandbags, waders and an inflatable dinghy. So did many others living on the border.
and while Orval and Wilbur Wright achieved the first controlled flight in a heavier-than-air machine at Kitty Hawk in the United States, I'd be investigating why man took so long to take to the skies when all he had to do was go up.
Many innovators studying the principles of aviation based their approach on the aerodynamics of bird flight. However, while some of the physics was sound, most assumed certain characteristics of the bird were essential if they were to get off the ground. These included feathers, a loud squawk, and an insatiable appetite for trill.
And as an old age pension of 5 shillings is introduced in Britain for those over 70 years old, I'll be quizzing internationally renowned economists why a proposal to give 12-year-old goblins in Ireland free tins of corned beef was quashed.
It wasn't so much the prohibitive cost of supplying said tins of corned beef that the government balked at. It was more to do with the fact goblins can be little shites.
All this and more next time on A Brief History of Failure.
A Brief History of Failure was written, performed and produced by me, Aid Corey. A book of this podcast is available from Amazon. And on Instagram, you can get additional content at A Brief History of Failure.